Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march or demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So you could just see $100,000,
deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven, the radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking, And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
By the time you met...
4 years ago, we started a microgreen farm. We started growing microgreens at home in our living room. And today we got to the point where we maxed out a room of 300 square meters. So today I'm going to give you a little tour of the room. And I'm also going to give you some really good tips for if you want to grow microgreens at home or you want to make it into a business. I'm gonna give you those tips in the end of the video. As you can see here, we're growing a variety of different kinds of microgreens. We basically turn this into a business where we are delivering microgreens like this in trays, still alive, for over 1,000 restaurant companies and catering, cafes, everything in Denmark. So we learned a lot on this journey about how to grow the product really nice so it looks fresh and it's the shelf life is really high in this product. And basically we grew from growing in our living room to growing in a basement to growing in a 10 square meter little room to 100 square meters, and now today we are operating in our own building where we have 300 square meters. In the back, we are growing mushrooms, as you saw in some of the other videos, and we really turned this into a way of living for us. We are employing around 30 people here in Denmark, with expanding into Czech Republic. Hopefully soon, we're going to expand into other countries as well. So this is like a really fun business to operate, because we are in the process of communicating a lot with chefs. We're communicating with other gardeners, and it's like a product that's alive, so it's really difficult to maintain the freshness if we don't sell it in the right way and if we don't sell it in the right time. If we sell it a little too late, then maybe the customers don't like that the product gets too big and the quality diminishes. So if we sell it a little too early, then the product hasn't fully grown out, and some people think it's a waste of money. So we really have to maintain a quality that like looks good and fresh all the time. And basically that's one of the hardest thing about doing a microgreen business, because that's what they don't tell you. It's really difficult to sell the product if you don't know how, and it's really difficult to maintain a stable quality. So yeah, we came around all those things and it worked out really great. And now we are doing 25 different varieties of microgreens. So I'm gonna take you a little tour around the room and you can see what we're doing. So you can see here the peas, they are really nice and fresh. We are growing these in different sizes. We're growing them really tall, or we're growing them like this tiny petite peas. They are really, really great. The smaller peas, they are much more fresh in flavor and texture, but the bigger peas, they just give a lot of spread on the plate. So the chefs who wants to use big peas, they want a lot of produce on the table. So yeah, some people like them tall, some people like them small. So this is, for example, our lentils. You can see here, they are really nice and fresh. We can grow them under strong light, or we can grow them under less strong light. We found that some species work really well under less strong light, and under strong light we need to grow other species. So the way that the light is, that if you are using white light, for example, then the taste of the product is much more sweet. If you are using a violet light, it's a bit more sour. The violet light is more intense, it's more efficient in energy consumption. However, it's not so nice working under violet light. We have a lot of young people working here, and we don't want them to use like special LED glasses when they're working in here. We just want a really nice, clean work environment that doesn't give you a headache or gives you a bad like sense of seeing, because you get all green in your eyes after working in a violet light for just 10 minutes. So it's really bad for your eyes because of the UV. It's so intense in the violet. The white is a bit more easy to work in. You don't need goggles. You can see here we're using the white light with red spectrum, a little bit of yellow in it, and a small amount of blue. We're using the Paris LEDs, so Paris Europe, we can highly recommend. It's the most efficient LED light for microgreens that we've been working with. We've worked with many, many LED producers like Samsung. We worked with Kind, with Spectrum King, with Fluence as well, and we found that Paris is really, really the best light for herbs, salads, and microgreens. So shout out to Sandro from Netherlands. Thank you for some high quality lighting. We really enjoy working with this, and we are growing really nice product within this light. We're moving a little ahead. So as you can see here, for example, we have some sunflower. Nice sunflower growing here. Basically almost all the shells are falling off by themselves. And we are in this room right now turning around, I think, with the mushrooms in the back and the aeroponic system over there that I'm gonna show you in a minute. I think we're turning around $20,000 every week right now. So we've expanded a lot since the last video we made, and you can check it out right here if you want to view that. It's really interesting working with all these. It's a live product. It has to be sold within 2 weeks maximum, because if the product gets a little too high, for example, we can see the peas here. They are like reached a point where they are about as high as they can be, because after around 5 days more of growth of this, then it's getting really difficult to store it on cool, because you have a much reduced shelf life in it, and it's not good for business growing the product too much. So you want to grow it as high as this maximum and then deliver it so you can make a new crop on the same space. Basically, all the space we have here is like around 2 to 3 weeks, and then it gets rotated, so we get new crops all the time. You can see here we have some garlic that's been growing, and it's really fresh. Give it one more week maximum, and then you can't sell it. So you have to all the time make sure that you're doing it in a way that makes the product not bad, but as fresh as possible all the time. This is the aeroponic system that we are operating. This is a system produced by Next Food in Denmark. It's operating only basil and parsley right now. We tested some lemon basil. You can also see that in another video. In the back we have Hjalmar. He is also one of the partners. Maybe you saw him in another video, but he is watering right now. So in all the microgreens we're growing, we're still watering everything by hand. And some people may think that that's insane, but since we have so much, we are spending like 1.5 hours every day watering, but we just figured that it gives us the best product possible, and we don't want to go on any compromises on the quality. So until we found the right watering solution for the way that we are growing microgreens, we are going to water it by hand. The aeroponic system that we have here, it's really nice, it's automated. We only put the plugs in, and then 3 weeks later, we have these fully grown basil and parsley herbs. We change the water in the tank, and then we give it fertilizer. We measure the pH value and make sure that the plants have everything they need. The lights is gonna be changed to Paris LED as well. So this system uses 2,500 watts. So 2.5 kilowatts per hour. With Paris LED, we're going to reduce that to around 1,000 or 1,500, so 1.5 kilowatts per hour maximum, I think. Hjalmar, he's watering right now. He's watering all the special herbs that we have. We are growing some shiso, some marigold, some basil, and yeah, basically some really different exotic herbs that you can get on your normal greenhouse. This is Tobias. He is working with us, and he's been working with us here for some time. He is one of the young people as well, helping us with everything we need. And in the back, behind the camera, is Rasmus. He is also one of our young people. He is actually cutting all the videos that we are doing, and he's doing a really good job. We are just trying to make everything work here as efficient as possible with the space that we have. And sometimes it's a challenge, but yeah, we are working very close with the chefs and with the other restaurants and the wholesalers, so we know all the time what people want and what they like. Alex, he is not here at the moment, but he's gonna be part of another future video for sure. He is the director, the CEO of the company, and he's also one of the creators of microgreens here in Denmark. Regarding the watering in the whole production here, we started testing these drippers. So we have a water tank, an irrigation tank in the back, and with connected with a computer and a pump, and then this is watering 2 times per day. Then underneath the trays, we have a big tray to collect the water and make sure that everything is watered from the bottom. And we are just still testing this. We tried testing it on the peas as well, where we had drippers everywhere, and that didn't work out so good. So we also started testing this system here, and it's a sprinkler system, and maybe I can show you how it works. We are also testing this system. This is a sprinkler system. We don't know if it works yet, but we are testing it, so I'm going to show you how this. So it's basically like just putting the water everywhere and sprinkling the water all over the trays. We don't know if we can make it work so that it like reaches everything and all the trays at once and doesn't water too much in the middle. That's one of our issues right now. So we want to see if we can make it work. And if not, then we are going to see if we can work with some other kind of way to do the automatic watering. But so far, we are hand watering everything and making sure that the product is the highest quality that it can be, because that's what we want to deliver. We don't want to compromise anything or work with bad products. We believe in what we do, and we believe in that a system like this can be set up so you can grow locally herbs, microgreens, salads, mushrooms, and deliver them to your local restaurant, your local canteen, cafeteria, whatever, and maybe provide more fresh food for the local environment in your area. So as promised, I'm going to give you a few tips on how you can become a profitable microgreen grower. So the first tip is basically that you should not see this as a way of like making money from day one. It takes a lot of time to get the product right, to get the communication right. But once you have the product right and the communication with the chefs, then it's a really nice business to work in. So the second tip is to just provide great service all the time. Provide the best service in your area. Make sure that your product is more fresh, much more beautiful looking, because that's going to give you an edge over the competition. And the third lesson I'm going to give you today is that you want to grow this locally. So if no one is growing anything like this in your area locally, then you have an edge, because people want to get more local food and they want to supply and provide with people who want to work with products like this locally when it's grown the closest to the plate as possible. Thank you for watching the video. I hope that you got some knowledge out of it. I hope you got some ideas about how you can start a microgreen business, or like what not to do now. And yeah, basically, if you have any ideas for future videos, let me know in the comment section and something you would like to know. And yeah, subscribe to our channel and give this.
I done had some things happen to me, man. President Obama's transition team. I was getting off a plane one day. Jesus. I done had some things happen.
So when people try to figure out how to make $1 million, they have no idea how daunting that is. Because if you know how to make $1 million, you go make it tomorrow. But since you can't figure out how to $1 million idea, you go somewhere and sit down. That's the wrong approach. If you apply your gift, your God-given gift that he gave you, you have millions already at your disposal. If you break it down inch by inch into things and cents, for the 10 by 10 theory, which is very simple. You don't need $1 million idea. You need a $10 idea. You need something that you do, your gift that God gave you, to make $10. That's all you got to be able to know. I don't care if it's cutting hair, cutting somebody's grass, washing somebody's car. I don't care if it's mowing somebody's lawn. I don't care if it's driving people to their destinations. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's baking cookies or pie. You have some braiding somebody's hair. You have something that you can do so well that someone will give you $10 for it. Write my paper for me. Do this for me. Somebody give you $10 for it. Once they give you $10, all you got to do is whatever you did to get that 10, do it 10 more times. You now, my friend, have $100. You have $100 simply because you took a $10 idea and you did it 10 times. Well, guess what? If you take that $100 that you made since you've done it 10 times and you do it 10 more times, I got news for you, my friend. You now have $1,000. $1,000, you make $1,000. Guess what all you got to do? You got to multiply that effort again. Do whatever you did to do $1,000, do it 10 more times. My friend, you now have $10,000. You got $10,000 now. Imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. Just imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. That's $120,000 a year. But I got news for you, my friend. Whatever you did, whatever it took to make yourself $10,000, all you got to do is do it 10 more times. 10 more times, my friend, you now have $100,000. I got news for you now. If you can make $100,000, you're just a step away from being a millionaire, man. Because now you hire a few more people to help you out that you can do portions of what you do so you can duplicate that effort. And one more time, do it 10 times. Man, that sounds hard. It is hard. But what else you got to do? What, you going to stop at the 100,000? All you got to do is duplicate your efforts by 10. You duplicate your efforts by 10 times 100,000. Welcome to the club, my friends. You are now a millionaire. Congratulations. You became a millionaire with a $10 idea. So stop bogging yourself down trying to figure out how to make a million. Do what you can do to make $10. And then do the 10 by 10 theory. Inch by inch, anything's a cinch. Now, here's the joyful part. Along the way, when you was down here making $20,000, but you did right here, and now all of a sudden you're making $30,000. Now you're making $100,000. But on the way to duplicating that times 10, you may stop along in here at $250,000. You can make it $250,000 a year. That's way better than that $20,000 you had when you started. So there's joy in the process. Your life is actually a lot richer at $250,000. It'll become even more richer at $500,000. It becomes even richer than that at $750,000, $750,000. If you don't get to the million, man, you're going to trip because you're making $900,000 a year? No, you're going to be happy. What, you don't make the million, so you only make $700,000 a year? You can't find happiness in $7,000? Something wrong with you, man. There's joy in the process. That's how you make $1,000,000.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself, right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right? And you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food. They are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you. And that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now, here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has, like, a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there are things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in, like, dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food, like, at a very high level, right? That's why people who... So for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? But I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, Can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude. Okay, I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian, like. It didn't matter if I was 7 or 17, why, the answer was always going to be the same, because I said so, right? So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay? Because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from, is present pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got a value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close. Until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great, okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time. And he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town. And then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again. And so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know. Pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you a for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, Brother Man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July, so that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be, oh, snap. I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking. Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, So, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake, then I'll eat some snacks, in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So But I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, oh, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids or how to win their present pursued victories, or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all tracking? Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those 3 things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those 3 categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. Or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1, and I call it the four levels of value. So, because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. Like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the thing that you, the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one. But I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer, and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what you have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who is limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say, I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass, you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a level of wealth, but a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by and I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell, they're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership, or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is, if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication, on the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay, so communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity, right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it, right? Okay. Well, so communication on this level, low end. you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance, right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, you might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, we got, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once, just get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like, I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 155, 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay. So, or you might... These people are coaches and teachers and actors and songwriters and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one, and YouTubers. It's crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like, YouTube? I have no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2022. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, this is how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization. Did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos. Hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months. Turned on monetization, and we got paid $305. And Zach's like, we made $305 last month. And I said, for what? Because somewhere along the line, I communicated a message somebody wanted to see, and Google or YouTube was able to sell an ad on that. We're talking about 100, 200, this is amazing. I looked at it yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen, so I didn't do it for this reason. Are you all tracking? What I'm about to tell you, I did not do for the reason I'm about to tell you what happened, okay? So we started doing YouTube videos intentionally April 1st last year. I looked at it yesterday. In the last 365 days, as of yesterday, we made $289,000 that YouTube paid us. I didn't know they were going to do that. No, you don't understand. I had no idea they were going to do that. Like, that wasn't why I did it. I mean, it was a nice side benefit, right? I've never had a job where I made $280,000 in my life. Most I've ever made at a job is $30,000, ever, as a full-grown man with a family. And YouTube paid me $289,000 for turning on a camera and running my mouth. Where the camera? Turn on the camera. I got something to say. The highest level of value is imagination. It still blows my mind. The resource you use at this level is your mind and your money to make money, to create value for other people. And what happens is at this level, on the low end, you're going to make $1 million. On the high end, it could be billions. And I know that sounds crazy. There's one YouTuber. This dude has 150 million subscribers. He gets over 100 million views a month. 100 million views. If he only makes $2 a view, that's 200 million a month. Are y'all tracking? It's just the whole world that we live in is kind of insanical. It's kind of the combination of insane and maniacal put together. This, so we can fight to stay down here, and people will do it too, because this, everything you do down here is hard. But I don't know if anything's harder than this, than thinking. Thinking is the hardest work most people never do. In fact, I believe that most people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they can maintain a state of mental laziness. They will work hard at what's not working so they don't have to think about what would work. Most people will work hard at what's not working so they won't have to think about what would work. They will maintain a state of physical diligence, like working their fingers to the bone, sweat, blood, tears, so they don't have to think about what would work. So they can maintain a state of mental laziness. Most people are so mentally lazy, it's pathetic. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Myron, I don't know the Bible you've been reading. I did not see that in chapter 1. Okay, I'm going to read it to you. It's kind of mind-blowing. So, a couple things. One is that Genesis chapter 1, I believe, if all God wanted us to know from Genesis chapter 1 was that he created everything, Genesis chapter 1 could have been Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then he starts going into all this detail. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. Like, what is all that about? Well, the first thing God tells about God is not that he is love, even though he's love. It's not that he's holy, even though he's holy. The first thing that God tells about God is not that he's omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, even though he is all those things. The first thing God tells about God is that he's creative. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What's the first thing God tells about us? The first thing he tells about us is that he created us in his image, which means he created us to create stuff and he made us to make stuff. What does that mean? What that means is when God created everything, after he created everything, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. After he did it, then he went back and documented the process, so when we got ready to create value for someone else, we'd have a pattern. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That was his intention. And the earth was without form. That word was not, used to be, it's became, without form and void. So disruption always follows intention, right? And darkness upon the face of the deep. So when disruption comes, it comes in the form of devoidness, deformity, and darkness. Like things get broken. There's confusion. Darkness is a picture of confusion and fear and anxiety. And then the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. So you have this intention, and then disruption follows your intention. So now you've got to find a source of inspiration. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God said, let there be light. That's illumination. You've got to learn something you didn't know so you can see something you couldn't see. Do you see what happens when we see, God's not just, he's not just, well, I just happened to do this. No. He's showing us what to do. And then he took time to see what he had created, and then he recognized that it was good. See, some of us, like, we'll go do all this really great stuff, and then we won't even take time to enjoy what we've created. You're not even being like God. Okay, y'all tracking. So it gets more better. So here it is, Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to show y'all where I got this from. Genesis chapter numero uno. Here we go. Here's what it says. When God created man, I'm going to just go down to that part. Here's what it says. Verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that moveth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God created him, male and female created he them. So, and God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Okay, so here's the first thing we see. And God said, it's really interesting. So if you go back and read Genesis chapter 1, what you'll see it says, and God said, like at Genesis 1, I think it's verse 3, and God said, let there be light. Maybe it's verse 4. And God said, let there be light, right? Okay, when God created creation, he said, let there be. Let there be light. Let there be a firmament that separates the waters from the waters. So When God created creation, there's three categories. There's creation, there's creatures, and there's creators. When God created creation, he said, let there be. When God created creatures, he said, let the earth bring forth and let the waters bring forth. Let the earth bring forth the cattle and the creeping things. Let the water bring forth the fish and the fowl. What is God doing? He's delegating some of the work that he did to something that he's already created. So we could call that delegation. We could call that automation. Right? Are y'all tracking? So that you're not doing everything. Okay, so y'all tracking. Okay, now, but when he created man, he didn't say, let there be man. That shows us that man is not a higher form of animal. He didn't say, let the earth bring forth man. He didn't say, let the waters bring forth man. So we know that man is very, very different than creation, and he's very, very different than creatures. How do we know that? Because what God said when he created them was different. When he created creation, he said, let there be. When he created creatures, he said, let the waters bring forth, let the earth bring forth. When he created man, here's what he said, let us. Let us make man in our image. I'm about to do something different, y'all, than everything I've already done. I saved the best for last. It's about to be on, y'all. Okay, now, God said, let us make man in our image. You know what that means? Before God could say, let us make man in our image, the image had to exist first. That's why imagination is the highest level, because it represents God. It's the God realm. God said, there's the communication. By the way, could God have made man in his image without saying it? Yes, he could have. But he said it. Why? Because that's part of our creative power, is to create messages that move us and messages that move others. Here's what the scripture says. A man shall eat good by the fruit of his mouth. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Thou shalt also declare a thing, and it shall be established where? Unto thee. I'm not talking about speaking things into existence. You can't do that. I can't do that. Only God could do that. That's a bara. The only person in scripture who baras is God. But what I can do is I can talk to myself like David did when he did what? Encouraged himself in the Lord. How do you encourage yourself in the Lord? Say the same thing to yourself that God said to you about you. When I speak God's word to me, guess what I'm doing? I am installing faith into a space where doubt used to exist, so I can take an action in faith that I could not take in doubt. How many of y'all track it? Why? How do I know that? Because faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by what? The word of God. So the best thing I can do for me is to say the same thing about me that God says about me. Because when I see myself like he sees me, now I can do what he says I can do and not what other people say I can't do. Are y'all tracking? And this is where I got the four levels of value, right? So when we're working at those highest levels, we're working that imagination realm. Then we start communicating, we're working that communication realm. But God didn't say, let me make man in my image. What did he say? Let us make man in our image. That's the unification part. Two are better than one, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Are y'all, this is so powerful for, the money is nothing more than proof that you've created the value. The wealth is the value that you create for someone other than yourself. And if you create enough value for enough other people, there's nothing in this world that you desire that you can't have. Now, and maybe that's not even what you want. There's nothing in this world that I desire that I don't already have. So somebody commented on one of my videos, somebody commented on one of my videos, they said, but you can't take it with you. And I can't take the lot I got with me, you can't take the little you got with you. We ain't taking none of it with us. That's first. But I said, I have neither the desire nor the inclination to take any of it with me. I'm not working to take it with me. I'm working so that I can keep contributing to the charities and the ministries that I contribute to, and so that I can leave the rest to my children, my children's children. I have no intention of taking it with me. I can send some ahead, and I can leave the rest here. I have no desire to take any with me. Myron, how much money do you want to make? As much as I can. How much wealth do you want to create? As much as I can. But wealth is not the money. Wealth is the value that I create for someone other than me. Okay, I gotta finish. The last thing it says, Genesis chapter 2, because I didn't realize Larry didn't tell me that I was getting ready to go over time, but that's okay. It's okay. Now I know who I'm dealing with. Okay. Larry's my dude. Okay, so here's what it says. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. I'm going to finish with this. God formed. What is that? That's the implementation. The last thing God did was made the physical part of man. Then what did he do? He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The man that he made in his imagination with his communication, patterned after his unification, he breathed that man into the body that he formed. And the man became a living soul. That's why I call these the four levels of value. Now y'all know where I got it from in Genesis chapter 1. By the way, it's confirmed in Genesis chapter 11. The people in Babel were trying to build a tower whose top could reach heaven. Do you know how ridiculous that sounds in a day where they don't have hydraulics, they don't have helicopters, they don't have cranes? But here's what it says. The Lord God came down to see the tower and the sun, the city and the tower which the sons of men built it. And he said, this people is one, that's unification. They all have one language, that's communication, and one speech. Now this they begin to do, that's implementation. Now nothing will be restrained from them, which they've imagined to do. They're the four levels of value. If you apply these four levels, even working on something that's not good, it will still work. That's how powerful it is, because it's a principle, and principles are God's automation. So let's make sure we apply the four levels of value to something good and not to something evil. I hope that blesses you. Thank you for subscribing. By the way, next Friday, which is the 9th, I think, of June, I am going to be doing a giveaway for subscribers. So you want to subscribe to my YouTube channel. If you haven't already, you want to subscribe to the channel, because we're going to be picking some subscribers. You want to subscribe publicly so people know, so we can pick from the people who subscribe, and we're going to pick somebody, and we're going to be doing a giveaway. I'm not going to tell you what the giveaway is right now, but I'll tell you on the Bible.
What's up, guys? This is Alex Martin. This is the Content Creator Podcast, where I stimulate your mind and show you how to market your grind. And today, we're going to stimulate your mind. I got the legend, the icon, Freeway Rick Ross. How you doing today, bro?
I'm good. How you?
I'm good, bro. Can't complain.
No doubt.
I can't lie, man. Right now, I'm like, I got the jitters.
You know, I've had the fortune or misfortune of surviving about three wars, 99 combat missions, 436 carrier landings day, night, and so forth, and 17 surface air missile engagements and one aircraft ejection. I feel like I'm a pretty privileged guy. But through that experience, there was some opportunity of meeting some truly incredible people, and the one pearl that I want to share with you in these few short minutes here is somebody in my mind that represents the greatest strategic genius of our time and has a tenet that's so widespread and the ability to utilize it covers such a broad swath that it served me well as countless others. Now, you know, who could this person be? Would it be General Patton? You know, the architect and the behind the Third Army and the successes that led to conquering the Germans in World War II? Could it be General Schwarzkopf, also the mastermind for Desert Storm? Or could it possibly be John Wayne? Because he's John Wayne. But really, the person I'm talking about right now that has affected more people than I can count is this lady. And her name's Mrs. Dorsett, and she was my third grade teacher. And I have to tell you about Mrs. Dorsett. She's one of these ladies in a school in McKinley Elementary School in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And this woman loved everybody. Now, to look at her, you'd see jet black hair. You'd see this, I call it a Halloween white complexion. and the brightest red lipstick you ever saw. And every kid left her classroom with red lipstick on their face. I mean, she even loved the smelly kid. More on that in a little bit, because I probably was the smelly kid. But she did, and she inspired everybody, everybody around her in her class in third grade. So what is this strategic genius? What does she have to say that is worth spreading? This. You have to use what you have at hand. It's brilliant. It's simple. And how she came across to explain this to everybody is that, I mean, imagine that at elementary school, the single greatest thing you wanted to do in the year was to go to the pet and hobby show. You could demonstrate your hobbies and let the principal judge them. And the best part is you could bring your pet. And this particular student of hers had a banty rooster named Woodstock. And he was proud of that chicken. And he wanted to show it off, but he ripped his pants before the judging could happen. And he was going to have to leave to maintain modesty. But Mrs. Dorsett said, let's use what we have at hand. So she took a stapler and oh so gently made him regain his modesty, and he was able to go to the pet and hobby show. Very simple story, but it's one that she reinforced all the time about everything. And I've used that over and over again. And it's worked quite well for me. Now, when you're 6 months old, and this is a picture of me, and my mom would say that that's a smile of satisfaction because I just loaded my diaper up to monstrous proportions. And so I'll try not to show you that look while I'm up here on stage, but no guarantees. But when you're 6 months old, you rarely know what things will happen, but you're guided by a number of influences on your life, and Mrs. Dorsett certainly did mine. Because when I got out of high school, I went to say, well, she said I have to use what I have at hand, but the bigger question was, what do I have at hand? And so I inventoried that. I said, well, I've got a work ethic, thanks to my dad. I've got a high school degree, and you know, what else do I have? Well, then it came information, and my father said, hey, our horseshoer is quitting to go into the feed business, so that'd be an opportunity. So information was what I didn't have at hand at that point, but then I go, okay, so I went and became a horseshoer. So what were the consequences of that? Well, it allowed me to go to college to help pay for that. That and a partial scholarship for sports, and then ultimately come to the cultural center of the universe, Oklahoma State, go Pokes. And it led to even more things that I had at hand, which was education, information, relationships, all of which is a potpourri that lets you execute using what you have at hand to do unbelievable things or things beyond what an individual would think they could do. So after graduating, eventually, with a degree in geology, from Oklahoma State, I did another inventory. What do I have at hand? Pretty much the same thing I had, but I had a degree. It was in geology in 1984, and the decline of the energy industry at that point was becoming traumatic, so an undergrad degree in geology didn't get you much. So I inventoried some more. I had a friend of mine that had a brother that was a geologist down working in New Orleans. Coincidentally, the World's Fair was down there, so we mixed business with opportunity, and away I go down and start peddling my resume in New Orleans, and I caught a fish. Luckily, went to work for Schlumberger for two glorious years of getting experience, education, sweating the summers in the Gulf of Mexico and freezing in 80 below up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the only well drilled to date up there, for two winters. And so that whole inventory, again, of what I had at hand or what was available, because in 1986, what happened there? You know, oil went down to about $6 a barrel or something like that. So looking down the road, it looked like that path was going to stop. So I read a newspaper, San Francisco newspaper, had an ad in it. Said, get an office with a view, Navy officer programs. And it had a pilot looking out of a jet down in the flight deck. And I said, maybe that's for me. And I'm going, well, let's see, what do I have? College degree, work experience, some degree of success in that and so forth. So I applied.
and by some act of God got accepted into that, was yelled at by a Marine Corps drill instructor for 3 months, and they said, okay, go to flight school. It was absolutely amazing. But using what I had at hand got me to that point. And then look at this video, because the challenges, look at the horizon on this video. Because the challenges that I found that I thought I could deal with, they got blown out of the water when I was figured out that if you're landing on an aircraft carrier, it moves. It moves every direction, forward, up, down, left, right. And the things that gave me comfort, especially at night. You know what happens at night when you land on an aircraft carrier? Two things. One, you find religion because you will pray to anybody that'll listen that you can get aborted alive. And the other one is it makes you the biggest sinner in the world because at the moment you're making promises, you know you can't keep them. So you find religion and you give God a lot to work with. So, you know, but what gave me comfort in that was being scared to death and inventorying what I had at hand. $20 million worth of training on just me. Same amount for my crew member in the back. Landing signal officer, a specialist on expeditious and safe recovery of aircraft. And 5,000 men and women, brave souls, whose sole purpose is to launch and recover airplanes and accomplish a mission in between time. But the original part of this was flying out. That was just getting home. That didn't deal with any of the other things. Now, you go to 1999, and there was genocide going on in the Kosovo province in the former Yugoslavia. A tragic thing to see from the air, actually, but we were asked to do something. NATO allies were asked to do an interesting thing. Without deployment of ground forces was to attack and stop the genocide with air power only. So what happened? Inventoried what we had at hand. We had lessons learned from Vietnam, some United States Marine Corps lessons learned that could be applied to that thing. And we had the brilliance of an Okie and an Okie State grad named Sodbuster Benson, who's a character in his own right. He looks like a mustache walking at you. But and he's the city manager of Enid. And 6 years before the need arose, he said, we need to integrate and do a few things. And that led to us being able to put together the mechanism in which to stop that genocide. Now, the next thing that happened after that, coming back from Kosovo, is ended up at Johns Hopkins University in this vault for secret stuff. And it was operators and people from the industrial complex to look at what are some mechanized solutions to what was going on over there. And really the challenges was informational and interpersonal. It wasn't on weapons. And so it came down, they said, we need a weapon that can hit moving targets. And what did I say? Let's use what we have at hand. It's a Vietnam-era weapon called a laser maverick. We've already got it. Let's not spend resources on what we think we need. Let's use what we have at hand. And so an Okie boy at Johns Hopkins University, a place I never thought I'd end up being, was quoting Mrs. Dorsett, my third grade teacher. It was amazing. So then in 2006, I get a phone call from a deep water drilling guy that read a white paper from University of Aberdeen, Scotland. And it basically said two things. The drilling industry would be well served if it used the best practices of aircraft carrier aviation and commercial aviation and space. The second part was if you had fighter pilots and astronauts teaching it, it'd be even more well served. And that started off on developing a syllabus of what we had at hand. Knowledge of the Top Gun syllabus, knowledge of air wing training syllabus. We pulled jets and aircraft carriers out, dropped in drilling rigs, and it worked magnificently to a great extent. And many folks are finding these types of things out when they realize what they have at hand and have the gumption and the wherewithal to expand what they have at hand. And Chesapeake and Nomac Drilling is a good example of this. Just a few short months ago, they took integrated these resources together, including Check 6, and put processes in place that cut rig move times by 60% or so. What does that mean? You can have the same number of rigs and access more energy. Or you can use less rigs to accomplish the same objective. It's using what you have at hand. I mean, my daughter, for example, is a teenage daughter. When her piggy bank starts running low but has the pressures of the fashion environment out there, and I go, honey, you got enough money? And she says, don't worry, Dad, I never pay retail. I use what I have at hand. And wouldn't it be wonderful if other parts of our great nation listened to Mrs. Dorsett? Congress, for example. You know, because the real thing with this is using what you have at hand, it defines conservation. I mean, it defines human grace. You know, it's the means to doing more with less. And what is TED? It's a corroboration event. We're finding out what we have at hand so we can use all this information to greater effect. You know, it's absolutely, in my mind, brilliant. And, you know, brilliance doesn't come in dramatic schemes and so forth. Sometimes it comes from your third grade teacher. Do this one thing for me. Let's all say this, like you mean it. Use what you have at hand. Come on, like we're coming from Oklahoma State. Use what you have at hand. Feels good to say it, doesn't it? Listen, thank you all. I hope this is something you can use. It served me well. Thank you for your tax dollars. It turned a horseshoer into a fighter pilot. Only in America. And thank you all.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.
If you have Medicare and Medicaid, then keep listening. You may qualify for a dual special needs plan from UnitedHealthcare. It's time you feel confident you're managing your whole health. With a dual special needs plan from UnitedHealthcare, it's not just health insurance, it's healthy living. You deserve coverage you can count on, so why not see how a dual special needs plan from UnitedHealthcare may help you get extra Medicare benefits? If you live in the D.C. area, see your options today at uhcdualplans.com.